Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present May Beauvais, Executive Director of the Climate Action Group 350.org, who assesses the lasting impact of Pope Francis's message on climate change delivered during his recent visit to the U.S. Gabory Benoit, a chemist and professor at the Yale School of Forestry, who discusses the toxic materials he's found in crumb rubber, widely used in playgrounds and athletic fields, and citizen activist and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who talks about his new American Tort Law Museum, which celebrates victories of law over corporate power. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Years ago, when the collapse of the Rana Plaza factory complex in Bangladesh caused the death of 1,129 sweatshop workers, the plight of garment workers hit the front page. It also opened the door in Southeast Asia for worker advocates and trade unions to mobilize. Top Western clothing labels had contracts with suppliers based in Rana Plaza. Firms such as JCPenney, Walmart, and Benetton had codes of conduct which proved no deterrent to dangerous sweatshop conditions. Up until the Rana Plaza collapse, Bangladesh had been a global center of low-cost garment production. Yet worker wages in Bangladesh remain among the lowest in the world. After the disaster, union activists pressured prominent European clothing labels to sign a global labor agreement known as the Accord to inspect factory conditions and to give unions direct access to garment workers. While the accord was endorsed by the International Labor Organization, few American clothing brands participated. U.S. companies, led by Walmart and The Gap, created a rival alliance with only voluntary standards and no enforceable commitments. According to the American Prospect, over 2,000 factories in Bangladesh have been inspected since the Rana Plaza collapse, which uncovered over 54,000 building code violations. Yet 30 members, or about 10%, of the Bangladesh parliament own garment factories, which explains why the government has for so long tolerated abusive conditions and resisted reforms. A year ago, the Los Angeles City Council considered a proposal to renegotiate its agreements with financial services firms. A report by the advocacy campaign Fix LA found that the city paid twice as much in banking fees as for street services. At the same time, LA has been under intense pressure to cut city jobs and delay infrastructure spending. State and local governments rely on Wall Street firms to arrange bond financing, manage investments, and provide financial services. And these banks make billions of dollars every year. According to the news magazine In These Times, progressive activists are promoting the idea that state and local government should use collective bargaining strategies when dealing with Wall Street banks. For example, cities could establish a nonprofit or publicly funded agency to set up guidelines for municipal finance contracts, rejecting deals that do not meet these standards. Three big cities, New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, combined do over $600 billion in business with Wall Street firms annually. This gives public officials leverage to demand lower interest rates and fairer terms, freeing up scarce funds for community services like parks, libraries, and schools. The state of Georgia is now a hotbed of prison reform, with expanded education programs for inmates to reduce prison recidivism. Under Georgia's Republican Governor Nathan Deal, the Peach State has halted prison expansion and reduced the prisoner population by 5,000 inmates. Instead of mass incarceration, the state is now focusing on diversion, treatment, and prisoner education. Professor of Criminal Justice Howard Zaire of Eastern Mennonite University observed that conservatives in southern states have embraced prison reform to cut costs. More than a few political leaders of the 1990s who pushed legislation to get tough on crime, such as former President Bill Clinton, now admit that many of these policies were misguided. But the question remains whether conservative states will spend prison savings on pet projects or whether they will continue to invest those funds on treatment and non-prison alternatives. While criminal justice reform has become a rare bipartisan issue in a polarized nation ahead of a major presidential election, that political solidarity could quickly crumble. A spike in violent crimes in a handful of cities, combined with fear-mongering political rhetoric from Republican presidential candidates targeting criminal Mexicans, could quickly undermine reform efforts. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Pope Francis began his recent visit to the United States with an address at the White House, in which he directly called for action on climate change. The pontiff said, "It seems clear to me that climate change is a problem which can no longer be left to a future generation." He went on to say, "When it comes to the care of our common home, we are living at a critical moment of history." The Pope's focus on the need for government action on global warming was a recurring theme during his trip, along with the issues of combating poverty and inequality. In a speech to world leaders gathered at the United Nations in New York City, the leader of the Catholic Church linked the issues of environmental destruction and poverty when he said, quote, "A selfish and boundless thirst for power and material prosperity leads both to the misuse of available natural resources and to the exclusion of the weak and the disadvantaged." Just days after the Pope departed the U.S. for Rome, a sobering new study was published by the U.S.-based climate research group Climate Interactive. They conclude that the emissions reductions announced by the U.S., the European Union, China, Brazil, and other governments in advance of the UN's December climate summit meeting in Paris still leaves the world on a trajectory towards 6.3 degrees Fahrenheit of warming by the end of the century. Scientific research predicts this level of global warming can lead to crop failures, critical food shortages, and widespread plant and animal life extinctions. Your reporter spoke with May Beauvais, executive director of the climate action group 350.org, who assesses the importance of Pope Francis's message on climate change and what's at stake in the upcoming UN climate summit in Paris.
I think Pope Francis's message has been critically important. I think it served as a real wake-up call for people around the world to see not only the growing threat of climate change, but how it's connected to so many other important issues that matter to people, issues like income inequality and social justice. I think Pope Francis has issued this clarion call to action that's about, we stand at a really crucial moment on this planet, and we can either act and take the shift away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy and in a way that actually builds healthier communities, or we can stay stuck in the pattern that we're in with very known consequences. We've already seen 1 degree Celsius of warming in the global average temperature. And just with that 1 degree, we've seen Hurricane Sandy, Hurricane Katrina, the drought in California, and on and on. So when we start thinking about temperature rise exceeding that, and by a great degree, that's putting millions of people's lives at risk. And so Pope Francis is, I think, first and foremost, a messenger about our obligation to our fellow human beings and to future generations. And that's why his message on climate change is so important.
May, there was some announcements by important nations around the world on their efforts to reduce their greenhouse gases and confront climate change. China talked about a cap and trade program that they were going to implement. Brazil also announced some hard and fast reductions in their greenhouse gas emissions and a commitment to stop the deforestation in Brazil. But at the same time, there were these very disturbing projections by the group Climate Interactive that said even if all these commitments come to pass, which is dubious, but even if they did come to pass, that the planet would be in a lot of trouble in terms of an increase in the temperature of the Earth towards the end of the century. Can you just expand on what the important message of Climate Interactive here is in their analysis?
Yeah, I think most of all, it points out just how serious the problem is and how much action is required to confront it. And, you know, those of us who are concerned about climate change can be rightfully accused of being downers. And this is, I think, a good example. On a week where there's tons and tons of good news, here we are saying once again, it's not good enough. But unfortunately, that's true. And as my colleague Bill McKibben likes to say, physics and chemistry don't negotiate. And we know that with the amount of carbon emissions in the atmosphere, we have no choice but to take dramatic action to prevent the worst effects of climate change. And it's going to take a lot. It's going to take even more. But there is finally momentum on our side. And for as long as this issue has been understood and scientists and activists have tried to force action, we're finally starting to see the pace of change that we actually need. And so I take great inspiration from some of the announcements made this week, because it shows that world leaders are starting to understand that they have to grapple with this problem at significant levels.
Tell us what's at stake at this United Nations Climate Summit, where hundreds of nations will be represented and people will be in the streets all around Paris and all over the world, making their voices heard on the urgent issue of climate change.
So what is at stake is an opportunity once again for global leaders to commit to crucial targets on climate change. What's different about these talks is that countries are supposed to come to Paris already having made a national commitment. And so individual countries are supposed to come to the table saying, we will commit to reducing our emissions by X percent. We will commit to reducing deforestation by X percent, these sorts of things. And it's up to the countries in many respects to implement what they've committed to. But in Paris itself, there are critical issues to be looked at. One is the question of finance. And to what degree are countries willing to commit real resources to helping countries adapt to the worst effects of climate change? Another issue we're looking at is what's called the ratchet mechanism. How will these individual country commitments be updated over time? And then lastly, really looking at what is the overarching global goal? If you add up all of these efforts, what does it really represent? A push to phase fossil fuels out of our economy at a certain point, to move to an economy powered by 100% renewable energy at a certain point. So this is some of what's under discussion.
That was Mae Beauvais, Executive Director of the Climate Action Group 350.org. Find more news and commentary on the Pope's visit and climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In June, a Connecticut-based group called Environment and Human Health received a grant to fund a study of the chemical compounds in ground-up rubber tires called crumb rubber. The material is increasingly used in place of wood chips or other protective coverings in playgrounds, and as the backing for artificial turf, which is now widely used on high school, college, and professional athletic fields. The study raised grave concerns, both for the hazardous chemicals found in the rubber and other compounds that have not yet been identified. Back in 2005, the Environmental Protection Agency indicated that 37 million rubber tires had been transformed into crumb rubber for various uses, out of the 290 million scrap tires that otherwise littered the landscape or were dumped into tire ponds, attracting mosquitoes and rats. Today, according to the EPA, 80% of scrap tires are now repurposed, mainly as fuel in highway projects or as crumb rubber for various uses. Neither the EPA nor any state health departments have raised the alarm about crumb rubber's potential hazards. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Gabori Benoit, a chemist and professor at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, who talks about the toxic materials he's found in crumb rubber and explains why he's concerned.
There's concern because ground tires are being used in a number of places where a lot of people are exposed to them, and especially younger people. So kids' playgrounds and athletic fields are getting thousands and thousands of these chopped up tires. And we know that there's a lot of undesirable toxic substances that go into the manufacture of the tires. And the question is, can any of those be extracted? And is there a risk the population's being exposed to them? The procedure that we used extracted close to 100 different organic compounds, and we don't ourselves do testing of their chemical nature, but that's already been done in a number of different studies. And what we found was that a large number of them are classified either as carcinogenic or as irritants of some kind, including respiratory irritants, and those are ones that can be harmful to folks with asthma. Although many of the compounds have been tested for their toxicity, many have not, surprisingly. And so on those, we simply have to say that we're not sure what the effects might be, but at least a large subset of them have been measured and have been shown to be either carcinogenic or irritating.
I recently saw a memo from the Environmental Protection Agency published in 2007 that was promoting recycling of tires as a positive for the environment. It actually specifically mentioned use of ground rubber, or what's called crumb rubber, in playgrounds, playing fields, and as garden mulch. Do you know if that's still happening?
As far as I know, they are continuing to promote it, and they do have a serious problem on their hands because there are, I forget the exact numbers, but there's millions of tires which go to waste every year. I think I recently saw that something like 80% of them are being recycled in some way, and that may seem like a good thing until you realize that these recycled uses are not permanent. So let's say you do put it into an athletic field. After a number of years, it physically just starts to degrade, and it has to be removed. And all of that material is not being recycled again. It's just being discarded. And so you're moving it from being discarding tires to discarding recycled tires. So you're not really getting rid of the problem by this recycling.
Are there any warning labels on crumb rubber that's sold for home or school or community use?
Several of the samples that we tested, we just went to the local big box hardware lumber yard and just bought bags of this stuff. The bags don't have a lot of information on them, except I think in some cases they kind of trumpeted the fact that they were sort of helping the environment by recycling tires, but there were no warnings whatever. And that surprised me a little bit, but I have no idea what the regulations are in regard to something like that. But no, there's no warning, nothing about exposure for children or, you know, and it's sold kind of as mulch. And of course, then there's also a risk, depending on where you put it, that the stuff is leaching out and getting into garden crops that people might have.
Gabriel Benoit, I recently took my 3-year-old granddaughter to one of these places where kids can pretend to be doctors or policemen or farmers. And there was a box in the farmyard filled with crumb rubber as if it was soil to plant plastic vegetables in. I spoke to the CEO there, and she said the crumb rubber is washed first, so she didn't think it was hazardous.
Well, I'm not sure how they're cleaning them. I suspect it's probably washing them with surfactants, which will indeed remove stuff from their surface. Because if you think about a tire, if you were to go out and pick up a used tire, your hands would be covered with all sorts of stuff, and they'd be black, and you can get rid of that stuff because you obviously don't want your kids playing in some kind of a sandbox and coming out looking like they're covered with dirt. However, that superficial dirt is only going to be there temporarily, and when you wash them, you're not washing the interior of the material, and stuff can get out of it. We are not at that point yet, but we'll be doing measurements, and others have done this in the past, where we look at the gases that come off of the tire. You mentioned that they stink, and in fact, that's just our nose being able to detect some subset of the compounds that come out, and we're going to be able to identify those and quantify them. So washing is a first minimum step that you'd want to take, but in this stuff, the kids are going to be playing right in it, and I don't know if you know, there's a condition called pica that a lot of kids have where they will ingest stuff that's really not food, and so kids are known to eat dirt, and I'm sure they're going to be eating some of this stuff as well, which is, that's really terrible. I don't care if it's washed or not. I don't think people want their kids eating ground-up tires.
That was Gabori Benoit, a chemist and professor at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. For more information on the hazardous materials found in crumb rubber, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Aspiring public interest lawyer Ralph Nader published his first book titled Unsafe at Any Speed in 1965. The book accused America's giant automobile manufacturers of producing dangerous vehicles that could be made more safe if the company's executives hadn't resisted the installation of safety equipment such as seatbelts and padded dashboards. The book is best known for one chapter, which dealt with the Chevrolet Corvair, whose flawed design, known to the manufacturer, made it prone to rear-wheel tuck-under crashes. Nader's testimony on unsafe cars before a Senate committee ushered in new safety laws in 1966. General Motors was later forced to apologize to Nader after it was revealed that the company had hired private investigators to tap his phone and attempted to entrap him in illicit relationships in order to discredit him as a public figure. Nader went on to become the nation's preeminent consumer advocate, who was responsible for at least 8 major federal consumer protection laws, the establishment of federal regulatory agencies, and the recall of millions of defective cars. Through the years, Nader has been instrumental in building a national network of nonprofit citizens groups, including state-based public interest research groups, the Center for Auto Safety, and Public Citizen. Throughout his career, Ralph Nader has used the courts and tort law, the law of personal injury, to pursue justice and hold the powerful to account. Now, after years of fundraising and planning, Nader has opened the New American Museum of Tort Law in his hometown of Winsted, Connecticut, which features many historic lawsuits, including those against the tobacco and asbestos industries, the Ford Pinto's exploding fuel tanks, and dozens more. In this excerpt of a speech made at the convocation of the museum on September 26th, Nader talks about the importance of tort law and the conservative movement attempting to erode consumers' access to the courts.
At the museum, you'll see how the tort system brought the tobacco industry to heel. It wasn't the legislature. It wasn't the executive branch. They were cowed by the tobacco industry and all its money and politics. But again and again, failing, finally succeeding, trial lawyers broke through. They spilled out the ugly guts of Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds. They got the conscientious whistleblowers. They got on 60 Minutes. They got on into the New York Times. And then the Food and Drug Administration began waking up, and some members of Congress. Again and again, one plaintiff lawyer with one plaintiff can put forces into motion to make us all safer. And why is that? It's because that courtroom is still open. It's because we have a right of trial by jury. It's because it's constitutionally protected. It's because it's open to the press. No closed tribunals, as we have with our trade agreements. No closed tribunals. Verbatim transcript. People cross-examining through their attorneys to find out the facts, the conditions, what happened. The jury determining the fact under the legal instructions of the judge. And then the appeal. There is nothing in our other branches of government that come close to this refereed accountable system. It is under attack. It's often grotesquely stereotyped by insurance companies and by companies like General Electric, General Motors, General Foods, the defense industries that are let off when they provide defective weaponry for our soldiers under some sort of doctrine that immunizes them for all practical purposes, with some exceptions. Let's face it. If we don't turn it around, who's going to turn it around? If we, the people, don't turn it around, who's going to turn it around? Our Constitution doesn't even use the word company or corporation. It doesn't even use the words political parties. Why are they ruling us? We start with the profession, the legal profession, that has had a lot of shortcomings. They have allowed erosions of the civil justice tort system in pretty outrageous fashion. They're sort of technical phrases that lawyers understand. Do you know what they all amount to? They say to you, if you're wrongfully injured, you're going to have to go over a lot of hurdles. You're going to have to delay. You're going to have to possibly lose. You may not be able to put your evidence in trial. You're going to be up against a war of attrition against you. Almost nothing we do every day does not have the potential of unreasonable risk by the negligence of others or the crimes of others. All life is risk. All activity is risk. You're on the highway, there are risks. But there are certain limits that others have to adhere to or they're going to be sued. If we utilize the legal system in far greater numbers, the more the perpetrators have to pay, the more they internalize the cost, the more they change the design of their products or their behavior, the more they protect apartment homes in terms of security against intruders. That was a case that's at the museum now that started the whole upgrading of apartment building security, brought by one plaintiff attorney and a woman who was assaulted as she was going into her apartment because the apartment building was not secure against an intruder. And so here's the nature of tort deform, as I call it. They want to get rid of strict liability, joint and several liability, punitive damages. They want to cap pain and suffering damages. They want to get rid of a lot of class actions or make it very difficult to bring them. They want to have their own corporate definition of expert witnesses. And they're starting now to give blanket immunity from any lawsuit to certain parts of our economy. Blanket immunity. There's no end to where they're going. And less than 1% of the American people, just being alert to the problem, when they buttonhole their legislators, when they talk to their friends at the water cooler or their neighbors, replacing small talk with some big talk, can turn this right around. You ask the American people, do they want their day in court? Do they want to be able to sue if someone hurt them negligently or criminally? You can bet they say yes. It doesn't matter whether they're conservatives or liberals, libertarians, progressives, you name it. The genius of the system of tort law is it's so constitutionally rooted that it is available to everybody. It doesn't matter, rich, poor, minorities, majorities, gender, it doesn't matter. It's available to everyone. And that's why we can be pretty angry at a bunch of corporations and their lobbyists and their money trying to take these rights away from us and trying to repeal the American Revolution of 1776.
That was citizen activist and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, speaking at the convocation of his new American Tort Law Museum in Winsted, Connecticut on September 26th. Find links to the museum's website and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.